is no place to escape to.
This is the last podcast
on the left.
That's when the cannibalism started.
Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together. We're back here. It is the deflating game, and we have our first contestant. Whoa. He is a tall glass of Bud Light, Woo. And his favorite thing is yelling at a TV screen at a sports bar. Ladies and gentlemen, put your hands together for contestant number one.
Yeah, I like cheese, I like beer, and what's your name?
My name's Laurie, and I just got a couple of questions for you, big old man.
Yeah, go
you smell big.
Yeah, shoot, Lori.
Now, these are real questions from the dating game.
Okay.
Convince me you're sexy, aggressive, and harmless.
Oh, God almighty. How could you be all three of those?
I'll take it. Okay, now tell me. When we've been married for 50 years,
yeah.
And now we're sitting on a park bench together and you start getting romantic. How come?
Oh, baby, you know I love how pigeons talk. All right, can we be done with this?
Hey, now tell me one last one. What football penalty are you mostly charged with on dates?
Oh, my good Lord.
That's from the dating game.
I'm going to say pass interference, because no pussy is safe when Ben Kissel's around. Or maybe interception, I don't know. Welcome to the last podcast on the left. What a horrible position that you just put me in.
Yep.
This is why I would never go on a dating game show. Dare I say, it might make someone a little crazy.
So you're blaming the dating game.
Well,
it was not the dating game, man. He was doing
I'm just telling you about my personal experience that I just felt, and now I feel like I need to have revenge on everybody because I was put on the spot, and I know I came in here to record a show. Yes, I know that my voice is being audio recorded,
yes.
But did I know we were going to peel back the layers of the Union to show the soul of the Kissel?
And you barely
I don't think so.
You barely did. You know what I mean? You've hit this level of agitation at the basic version of dating interrogation.
Yeah, how's dating going? Oh, just so nice. So nice. All right, everyone, go Pat, go. Today, we are on to an episode that has been in the minds of everyone for many, many years. And I'm just so happy we waited this long to get to it, because this story, evidently, from what I heard, is pretty freaking disgusting.
Yes.
So we shall get into it. The lightheartedness is going to ease up a little bit. We are talking Rodney Alcala.
Yeah, that's it.
All right, thank you.
What you didn't hear is that Kissel tried to say it three times, but it is difficult. And guess what? Rodney Alcala, who gives a fucking
shit? Who gives
a shit? He's dead.
Yeah, indeed. Thank God. You have no last name once you're dead.
Rodney Alcala was an American serial murderer who provably killed 10 women and children between 1971 and 1979, although his murdering career may have, and probably did, start much earlier than what we know.
This is one of those subterranean serial killers. Because you know how many times we've talked about in the past about how, in our minds, a lot of times, serial killers are fairly obvious coming towards you. Right?
Like Richard Chase covered in blood.
Jeffrey Dahmer, herky jerky dancing in the club late at night. Like there are things that I think tell a serial killer, like kind of transmit the signal of a serial killer.
People get the spidey sense that someone might not be necessarily right.
Yes, but Rodney Alcala
minded.
Does not have any of those signals.
Okay. No.
Now, although Rodney is most often called the dating game killer, owing to his appearance as a contestant on the popular game show in 1978, a more accurate name for Rodney might be the picture killer. See, Alcala was not a berserker like Ted Bundy. He was not a sneak-up-and-shoot killer like David Berkowitz, nor was he
stumble-around-and-shoot killer like David Berkowitz.
Nor was he a hunt-and-kill animal like Andre Chikatilo. Instead, Alcala was a wolf in sheep's clothing, using his good looks and charm to lure potential victims, especially the children, with a simple question. Want to see a pretty picture?
Again.
Oh my God,
again,
dude.
And again, how many times have we said throughout the years of last podcast on the left, no one is a photographer.
No, no one is.
No one is. There is. There's maybe four. Again, if you just meet somebody who says they are, they're not.
No.
No.
And the pretty picture is just going to be their cock after a rubber band has been tied around it for 10 hours. You'd be like, look at it. And be like, it's kind of purple in it. And be like, thank you for showing me that pretty picture.
Does that happen to you?
No, but I'm just saying, at no point is the picture actually pretty. They're not showing you an Ann Getty with a baby as a cabbage.
That's. I feel like that's more predatory
than a fucking cock. Swollen for 10 hours.
If I met a woman randomly and said, you want to see a fun picture? And I pulled a crumpled Ann Bettis picture out of my fucking basketball shorts.
If you do it, okay, I understand.
Now, as we'll see, Alcala was just as, if not more scary, than a break and enter killer like Richard Ramirez. But since Alcala never admitted to any of the murders, and therefore never talked about them, he never quite caught the attention of the media like some of the other famed serial killers did.
But that's kind of what makes him scary, right? The lack of showing his ass.
Right.
Speaking to that point, Alcala honestly seems like the type of guy that's just too scary to talk about. A killer with no real victim type, no age bracket, and no preference on where he commits the murders, in addition to being nomadic and inhumanly brutal. Alcala beat, strangled, raped, molested, and burned. He used his nails, his fists, his hands, and hardware. He ripped, he mangled, he mutilated, and then posed the bodies afterwards in such horrifying ways that they rival the crime scenes of Danny Rowling. And they were made all the more shocking by virtue of being done in public.
Was actually the intro of The Dating Game when they brought him out. Isn't that? It was a little cryptic. It was a little cryptic, I thought, but wow.
But he's the type of guy, Marcus and I, this is maybe uncouth, but Marcus and I talked a little bit during our production call about the concept of some serial killers are in it for an explosive reaction that they get from their crimes and they long to be caught, like Jeffrey Dahmer. Even in his own way, John Wayne Gacy, even though he did his best to hide it, just the idea of keeping all of these bodies inside of your own home, eventually you know for a fact, so even if it's deep, deep compartmentalized deep down, someone's going to figure this shit out one day.
At some point, yeah.
Right? But Rodney Alcala is what you'd call a career killer. He is the type of person, very similar to BTK, that would have gone on to continue to kill for as long as possible. And the way you do that is that you don't talk about your crimes. So unlike other serial killers that we've talked about in the past, about how their numbers are probably exaggerated because they talked shit so much after they've been caught, somebody like Rodney Alcala probably has many more victims than the one he was caught with.
Wow, that's so much more scary.
See, Rodney's only consistent MO was in how he lured his victims to their doom. Alcala was a photographer of some small talent, and using his camera and his charm, he was able to both isolate his victims and lower their inhibitions by appealing to their vanity, all without using any force. Furthermore, Alcala was also operating at the same time and in the same places as some of the most notorious serial killers of the 70s completely by coincidence, which ended up muddling investigations on opposite coasts.
Or it's all the lead!
What do you mean it's all the lead?
The lead poisoning.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
It's why it's happening all at once. There's so many serial killers happening at this time period.
Yeah.
And in the three locations, he killed people. So
not even three. He probably had dozens of locations because he was constantly going from New York to L.A. for years.
Henry, I've been eating lead for the last 25 years, and I have never even thought about hurting anyone.
Honestly.
As a matter of fact, mostly I hang out with dogs.
It is really, really nice to have you here, Dr. Fauci. I'm trying to figure out another name.
Well, what all this amounts to is that Rodney Alcala's true body count is undoubtedly far, far higher than the 10 that were provable. And after we're done with this series, you might join us in thinking that Alcala may have been one of the most prolific and dangerous serial killers in American history.
He's certainly no Ann Geddes.
No, he is not. Nice hair, though. I do have to give him some credit on that, I suppose. Well, so even when
he's got what's his name's hair? He's got the guy from Queens hair.
Freddie Mercury.
No.
Ooh. No, Brian May. He's got the Brian May hair. Yeah, he does have Brian May hair, without a doubt.
So even when he got Rodney, even when he got to prison, he didn't start bragging. He didn't start going.
No, like never.
That is really rare. Okay.
Never.
Interesting.
He was in prison for 50 years and never once even came close to copping to any crime.
I'm sure we'll get to it, but was it guilt?
No.
He's the type of person that these crimes are his secrets and also his prizes. The things, the memories that he has are sacred to him. We don't like making guys out to be super scary on Last Podcast on the Left, like, because the whole idea is that mostly these people are ineffectual dorks.
Dumpy
they
shits.
Can't fucking do anything.
Yep.
Ronnie Alcala is just one of those, like a Richard Ramirez or a Ted Bundy, who is actually very, very dangerous. It's okay. The type of person that you can be very easily fooled by because he's tall.
He even got by the producers of The Dating Game.
But yeah, because he viewed it that as private.
Okay.
His murders were, and what he did was for him. It was what he did, and he does. I think that in some way, shape, or form, deep inside, he viewed that if you told everybody the details of his crimes, it would sully the sacredness of the act to himself.
Like a macabre mental inganga, perhaps.
Mm. Yeah, something like that. Yeah, but I think the reason why he didn't talk about the crimes ever is I think on some level, there was something in his mind that said, maybe I'll get out. Yeah. Maybe I'll get away with it. Maybe, because that's how much killing was a part of his DNA. Because that's really all that mattered to him. The only thing that mattered to him was killing. That's it. Everything in his life all informed that urge.
Yeah, so he's thinking, so did like, he get passed at the cellar?
Good joke.
But yeah, I think that's why he never talked about it. Because he thought that maybe he can get away with it.
All right.
But before we get into the story, which is going to get very brutal very quickly, let's acknowledge our source. Today, we've got The Dating Game Killer by Stella Sands, which is another well-researched meat and potatoes true crime narrative.
Ooh.
Now, one of the things that's most baffling about Rodney Alcala is that despite the severity and sheer volume of his crimes, his childhood was bereft of abnormal tragedy or abuse. And in this, he's like Dennis Rader, aka BTK, who also seemed to have come out of the womb as a fully formed predator.
And stealthily so. Because as a little kid, he didn't do any of the telltale shit that said that later on he'd live a life of crime. So he was kind of this picture-perfect little boy, which again, it's some form of, does it lay in wait? Or is it always there?
Hmm. Yeah. Rodney Alcala was born Rodrigo Jacques Alcala Bucois on August 23rd, 1943, in San Antonio. One child amongst four others.
Man, we can't get his head out because of the bow tie. My goodness, he changed his last name into something less French.
Make this pussy wetter.
Oh my goodness, that's a horrible doctor thing to say.
As a youngster, he got good grades, he was well-liked, and was never reported to have any significant problems whatsoever. The one trauma of his childhood was when his father abandoned the family when Rodney was 12. But that sort of thing has been happening every single day since the concept of family was established.
Men have been trying to not have the concept of family for a long time.
And the sort of sustained trauma that usually produces a monster like Alcala commonly starts far earlier in the killer's life. Now, after Rodney's father abandoned the family, never to return, the remaining Alcalas moved to Los Angeles. There, Rodney dated, took piano lessons, lettered in cross country, and joined the yearbook staff, showing no signs that there was a murderous rage bubbling up inside.
Yeah, the sign is right there. It's called the yearbook staff.
Yeah, dude. Anyone who's
on the yearbook staff.
Yeah,
controlling.
Okay, there's also, again, 11 people in your class. 11 people in your class. And also, like, all of the pictures. You get everyone's pictures. You get all the insight. You're behind the scenes. You see how the sausage is made. Yearbook. The staff, it gets disgusting.
They're so mean, and they're exacting, and they're all like, I control the purview of this entire school and the history of this school.
They choose what pictures are shown. They choose how to make fun of you.
They're the Goebbels of the school.
Why didn't I get a picture of me wrestling in the yearbook?
Mm. They didn't want to have all the people rise up against the giant amongst them. Kill the beast.
Very funny. I wonder if I'll get passed at the cellar. Wow. Such great jokes here.
After high school, Rodney joined the army to become a paratrooper.
Oh.
But ended up serving his time as a clerk, which was something he was quite good at, unlike other serial killers who spent time in the service.
Yeah.
I actually did a little bit of research into this connection right? Because we've had many serial killers pop up that have military experience.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like there was a draft or something.
Yeah, they were kind of forced to.
But I mean, also, he joined in the late 50s, early 60s. Okay. He wasn't drafted. But not yeah, yet. I mean, you got Leonard Lake, you got David Berkowitz, you got Dennis Rader.
Dennis Rader. And I was looking at this, and they all kind of say the same thing, the studies that we're reading, which, I mean, most of it makes sense, which is the idea of disengagement, the concept of you create a killable human in your mind. Like you basically, that's why they have like their targets are just silhouettes of human beings. Mm-hmm, so you mm-hmm. stop thinking of them as people. And that's one thing. But I don't think it explains it all, because most people come back from war while they are scarred. A lot of the times they don't come back wanting to kill more and more people.
Well, I mean, I think a sniper probably has less PTSD than someone who has to work in the clerical section.
I ask a sniper.
Oh, I got all the paperwork. Oh, some God. Snipers are very happy.
Yeah, I'm very scared. To ask a sniper. But the one thing that came up that I thought was interesting is they said the one common thread about people that sign up for the military is they said they score low on agreeable meters. And I was like, what does that mean?
Yeah, what does that mean?
I don't know what that means. That's what they said. They said that people that join the armed forces are, on the whole, less agreeable.
But don't they have to all agree to get their asses kicked for like 10 years in basic and then go get yelled at all the time?
I think it takes a highly independent spirit that then gets funneled into something. But it's weird, because how does that also, like, how does that create a serial killer? I'm not certain.
Okay. No, it doesn't at all. Not even close. Because if you look at the serial killers that we've covered who have military service, the number of serial killers who saw combat is zero.
Yeah. Mm.
Seriously zero. Like there was, I remember there was one, who was the guy that said that he, I can't remember which serial killer that like made up a whole bunch of fucking stories. He might have been in combat, but.
Leonard Lake.
No, but Leonard Blake wasn't like most of them worked in like radar or fucking clerical shit. Like Berkowitz never saw combat. Leonard Lake never saw combat. Dennis Rader never saw combat. No. He was stationed in Japan and actually spent most of his fucking time stalking Japanese women like off base.
So there was a different kind of training.
I suppose so. All
it really was. No, that's where Dennis Rader learned it, was stalking women in Japan.
The world's fattest ninja.
But that's why, that is the only thing that Rodney Alcala has that you can compare to other serial killers as being like, I guess something ticked him off, or something happened, and it happened when he was at the military. It happened when he was in the military, and we don't know
when Henry says that, what he is referring to is, thank you for your service. Thank you for your service.
Yes.
One and all, thank you for your service.
Rise from your grave.
Well, things started breaking down in 1962 when Rodney was informed that his father had died at the age of 55. Even worse, Rodney discovered that the elder Alcala had remarried and started a new family since leaving his first brood.
That should show, though, man. If daddy be fucking, then baby can be fucking. If daddy fucking at 55,
this is a deleted scene from Boss Babies that I don't know about.
I'm the baby, right? That means when I'm a big baby, when I'm 55, I can still be fucking.
Sure, he died at 55, but yes.
Well, about a year later, Alcala arrived at his mother's home unexpected, having gone AWOL from the army. This was especially surprising because Rodney had been stationed at Fort Bragg in North Carolina, and that meant that he'd hitchhiked all the way to Los Angeles.
And this is actually kind of creepy, because he just shows up just being like, hey, mom, what's up? And they don't know why he came home. He had no reason. And apparently in the army, what he was just kind of doing where he was just not doing stuff.
Yeah.
Like, he kind of went through this period of time where they'd go, like, I guess it reveille when you're supposed to go and like, meet up with all the other boys and sit around. Everyone gets measured for heights and everybody compares shoes.
Sure.
What happens, right? He was supposed to go, and he just kind of sit. And they'd be like, private, let's go. And he'd just look at them, just be like, today the day I go, or is today the day I sit? Because I think I need some cot time.
He needs a little cot time. Very Kenan Thompson from SNL. He's just there. He's just there. And he's making a paycheck. And that's why we love him.
Well, Rodney eventually turned himself in for going AWOL, but he was hospitalized instead of jailed. Well, according to his superiors, as Henry said, Rodney had suffered a nervous breakdown in the weeks leading up to his desertion. And upon the routine examination, following this mental breakdown, Army psychiatrists discovered some disturbing and surprising things.
He eats steak with a spoon.
Must be a really nice steak.
Even though Rodney has shown no signs of being anything but stable, as far as we know, he was discharged from the army after being diagnosed with antisocial personality disorder, chronic and severe.
Do you think he just sat in a chair upside down and did like Robin Williams did when he auditioned for Mork and Mindy?
Oh, is that what he did?
Yeah, they were like, oh, why would we need to cast anybody else? There's an alien right here.
Wow.
Nowadays, you get kicked out for that.
Yes, indeed.
They'd hate that.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think that, I don't know what happened in that interview, because it's really fucked up, right? Because no one talks about him having antisocial disorder, any fucking blip on the screen. Yeah.
Well, let me get into it a little bit. I mean, antisocial personality disorder is basically the serial killer's disease.
Sure.
But, and you know, it's like not all people who have APD are serial killers, but all serial killers have APD to some extent.
Isn't that a big old, like, umbrella term, too, for, like, you're
It's pretty
nasty.
Umbrella.
Yeah, yeah, like, it's one of those, you're mean. He's a mean guy. And so they right. kind of just give you APD.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's characterized by a long-term pattern of disregard for the rights of others with a weak or non-existent conscience, coupled with a... What do you mean, Baron Nat? That's fucking awful.
Rock and roll, it's terrible.
I don't know if that deserves a guitar.
I got an antisocial personality disorder. You can see I hold my jacket together with pins.
I think you are greatly not understanding what we're talking about in a medical sense. This is not someone in an antisocial sweater or sweatshirt. You know what I'm talking about.
And all this is coupled with a history of impulsive or aggressive behavior. But Rodney hadn't yet exhibited any of the overt symptoms that usually flash a red light for antisocial personality disorder. And this is really what made Rodney Alcala so dangerous. While many serial killers can't help but attract attention towards themselves, even outside of their murders, Alcala, like BTK, could go under the radar.
Wow, that's so scary.
Yeah, he just they did the tests, which I'm sure, like, it's, I mean, it's not the type of test where
here's a baby, stab it or yeah. feed it. You know what I mean? Like, stab it.
Yeah.
Stab that's not the right answer.
Ah, fuck. You only gave me two options.
Yeah, well, okay, we're going to give you the question again with the two options. You know for a fact stab it is the wrong answer.
Okay.
Here's a baby. Stab it or feed it.
Step.
Okay. Step. Well, this is
feed it. You feed it.
Okay.
You feed it. Here, suck on my tits.
No.
Suck on my tits,
wrong
baby.
Wrong answer. Somehow the right answer, but yet the wrong answer.
Really, the only reason why Alcala ever got caught is that he focused on the victims that garner the most attention in America. Pretty white women and little white girls.
Oh, my God. I didn't know all the kids stuff.
Yeah.
I really didn't.
Man.
Yeah,
you're dude, about to. You're walking right. chest first into it, my
great,
friend.
Great, great.
It begins and ends with it. Relatively soon after he was discharged from the army, he would attempt his first murder of the latter.
Can I also have one other question before we get into Gold Star territory? Do you think that in this meeting, when they had this, they kicked him out for antisocial personality disorder, do you think it's one of those things that they also could have labeled him with something just so they could kick him out of the army because he was bad at it? Like, does it go that far, or is there other things that they say?
Don't they just want you to stay there and then they punish you a whole bunch, and then that's kind of fun for them too?
But if you're like touching guys' dicks while they sleep and stuff, a lot of times, unless everybody's doing it one big daisy chain, I think that most of the time they say like he's suffering from exhaustion or like something like that.
They just put you in jail.
Yeah, they just put you in jail because he'd gone AWOL by this point.
Mm.
And it's just, and they just fucking, yeah. That's just, if they think like, oh, you're just not good at it and you ran away, you're going to jail.
Really?
Like, bar none. Yeah. Yeah, dude,
we're
going to jail.
We're talking about some of us aren't supposed to be soldiers, man.
No, that's why you didn't volunteer to go. Also,
yeah,
you may have not been recruited.
I think that's possible. I'm here to choreograph the summer play.
Oh, my goodness. All right. And just last point before we really get into the deep dive. Do you think he didn't talk about his crimes because Ted Bundy didn't talk about killing the girl? Do you think it was because it was child related? And if he fucking mentioned he killed children, off with his head in prison.
No, because we'll get into that. We'll get into that immediately, why that doesn't hold up.
Okay.
Well, after recovering from his nervous breakdown in his mother's home in Monterey Park, California, Alcala returned to his old, charming self and was accepted to California State University, where he graduated with a bachelor's in fine art, focusing on photography, in 1968.
Cal State's not fucking around, too. Cal State's a legit,
that's the
legit
thing about
school.
Rodney Alcala is also a lethally intelligent person.
Mm.
Like, his IQ, I mean, I know IQ is like whatever, but still... His IQ was 140 when he took the test at Cal State. He's highly intelligent. The next fall, motivated by some mysterious reasoning, Rodney Alcala tried killing for the first time. But like I said, since Alcala has never admitted to any murders, he might have been killing long before this one. This is just the first one that he got caught on.
The nature of the crime, it does sound like someone already in mid-escalation.
Okay.
On a nice day in September, Rodney Alcala
Gold star warning.
Oh, gold star.
That's me. That's me jingling a gold star at you like you're a dog. Bark, up. Okay. Gold star up.
Yeah.
Be warned.
And this is the first of three in this episode.
Okay.
Let's just go ahead and say this is a gold star episode. This is just a full-on gold star episode.
Okay.
On a nice day in September, Rodney Alcala was driving his car down Sunset Boulevard when he noticed an 8-year-old girl skipping down the sidewalk. He pulled over, stuck his head out the window, and learned that the little girl's name was Tali Shapiro. Using the oldest trick in the book, Alcala offered her a ride to school, saying that he was a friend of her parents.
Uh-oh.
Now, this didn't convince Tali, but when Alcala said he had a pretty picture to show her, she hopped in the car. Now, the only thing that saved Tali Shapiro's life was that a good Samaritan named Donald Haynes was also driving along Sunset Boulevard and saw that a man was obviously trying to convince a little girl to get into his car.
And what's weird is that she was staying at the Chateau Marmont, which also has like a history of weird shit going on. So this whole area is like vaguely shady as it is.
Wow. Yeah. After she got in and they drove off, Donald tailed them to Alcala's apartment on DeLongpre Avenue, where he watched them both walk inside. And sensing that all of this was very wrong, he called the police and told them the whole story. Asking, hey, can you just check on this so I can fucking sleep tonight?
What do you mean, and ruin that little girl's audition? This is Hollywood.
Oh my goodness.
Unfortunately, though, the LAPD doesn't exactly jump on situations that only have the possibility of being bad. So when the cops showed up knocking on Rodney's door, some time had passed. Upon hearing the loud banging, Alcala popped his head out the window and told Officer Chris Camacho to give him a second because he'd just gotten out of the shower. When Rodney didn't open the door, and when he stopped communicating altogether, Officer Camacho broke inside. And immediately, Camacho saw that there were piles of lewd photographs of young girls all over the room, and a fresh trail of blood was leading from the living room to the kitchen. When Camacho ran to see where it led, he found Tali, naked in a pool of her own blood. In the time between their arrival and Officer Camacho's, Alcala had strangled, beat, raped, and bashed in the skull of Tali Shapiro. Finally, he'd lain a heavy metal bar across her neck as the slow instrument of death.
Oh, my God. Because
presumably, Alcala was watching her slowly choke to death when Officer Camacho showed up.
This is what I'm talking about with an escalated approach. If this wasn't his first crime, he thought about this for a long time. Because what he knows...
Yeah, you're right. He seems mid-game here.
Yes, and also the pictures. Because he already had hundreds of pictures. So he's already been testing...
Were these pictures he took or were these published
pictures?
Yeah,
pictures he took. His pictures.
Oh, my
Always God. Pictures he took.
Oh, yes. Lord.
And so we now know that this is not the... this is definitely, I mean, in my mind, not the first time, right?
Yeah, me too. I think so, too.
But he's very similar to BTK, which I think is what makes him hyper dangerous, because this is the thing, is that he does not kill quickly. It is a long progressed period, and he does the choke and release over
like
and
Shaw
over
Cross.
Again. Yes.
Instinctively, Camacho removed the bar from Tali's neck and checked her pulse, only to find that she was still alive, but just barely. Alcala, however, had run out the back and was long gone.
Yeah, because he had to make a choice. He saw the guy jumping. He basically saw him jump out the back window. And he's like, I could either get this girl out of this apartment or I could go after the guy.
Yeah.
He chose
correctly. Save the little girl's life.
Of course. And then Rodney had the very difficult decision of like, do I leave or do I stay with all my pictures?
My pictures.
Oh, man, my pictures.
Yeah, it's back in the day. There's no iCloud.
There's no cloud. Oh, my God. What a horrible scene.
Natalie eventually regained consciousness, but after she relearned how to walk, her family quit their jobs and moved to Mexico, while Tali, mercifully, still maintains that she remembers none of what happened after arriving at Alcala's apartment. And she'll talk about it. She's been on documentaries. Like, there's a Rodney Alcala documentary that I think CBS did that she talks about.
She just started
experience.
Talking about it because she didn't talk about it for years.
Poor girl.
Because as we'll see... Rodney Alcala had a hard time staying in jail.
Yep.
Because I'm like, this is all before the dating game, right?
Oh, way before.
Okay,
way
again, before. Producers out there, just triple check. Make sure every contestant has never killed her girl.
We'll find out.
Dude, this
sometimes
is...
that's the pull. Have you seen F-Boy Island?
Dude, this was a decade before the dating game.
Oh my God, okay.
Well, concerning Alcala, after fleeing the scene, it became evident that he could no longer stay in Los Angeles, at least for the time being. So, as was possible in 1968, he moved across the country to New York City, where he applied and was accepted to NYU under the false name of John Berger.
Man, I couldn't even get a pass to go visit NYU.
Also, for being a supposed high intellectual, John Berger.
Oh, I mean, Johnny Berger. Hey,
Johnny Berger.
My name is John Berger. John Berger.
John Fish Taco. No, Johnny
Guacamole. Johnny Guacamole.
He is a creative. Welcome to NYU. Lady Gaga killed her roommate.
All right, stop
stole
with your
her fucking act.
Between that and the Tom Cruise fish fucking, I think you have a lot of opinions up there,
she
Mr.
killed her
Zabrowski.
Roommate. She definitely is. Okay. She's a dangerous woman.
All right.
Incredible artist.
Great.
From 1968 to 1971, Alcala attended classes, worked as a security guard to pay his tuition, reportedly worked well in group film projects, and in his first brush with an infamous killing, took classes taught by Roman Polanski just before Sharon Tate was murdered.
I wonder what they talked about.
Yeah, they could go out and troll for the same girls.
Yeah, that's so weird. Because you can almost see the friendship happening where they both grab for the same 12-year-old girl and they look at each other like,
Roman, oh, Roman, oh, Rodney.
Isn't that funny? Yeah, I was going to harm that young innocent person and you want to harm him too.
Hey, stop calling me Rodney. The name's Johnny Berger.
Oh, I'm sorry, Johnny Berger. Johnny Berger, of course. And my name is Roman Burrito. I don't know.
Keep it Polish.
Okay. Roman pierogi sounds like he produces four.
It does.
Welcome to Roman pierogi. Bend over at the waist, please. Oh.
Well, every summer starting in 1969, though, Alcala worked as a counselor at a drama and arts camp for girls in New Hampshire.
Right.
No.
Hey, dude, nothing happened. There, he was known as the most popular counselor to all the girls and was considered to be a natural-born, even brilliant teacher by all his bosses. He taught there for 3 years.
Can I say my belief system is that he did that as training?
Mm.
I think that to speak to people, he did it as human training.
Mm-hmm.
I think that he wanted to put himself, and because how many times these guys talk about this? It's a self-challenge. Where they go in, and like, guys who lead double lives for a long time. Like BTK. I can guarantee it's very similar with the BTK story, where he gets off on hiding in plain sight. It's a part of an extended fantasy.
Yeah. And I think it's also, he's trying to graduate, because his game really is to lure people in using nonviolent means. That's part of the jolt, is tricking people. And it's one thing to trick
a child.
He's
also a pussy. He's a pussy, so he can't fucking confront somebody. He wants to trick you so that he can get you with the least amount of hassle.
Mm-hmm. But it's one thing to trick a child and another thing altogether to trick an adult.
Yeah.
And he's trying to figure out, how do you trick adults? Like, or at least older girls. You know, these are all like late teenagers. But in 1971, Alcala returned to his murderous ways. Or perhaps a more appropriate thing to say is that 1971 is the first time that Rodney can be linked to a murder. And while we don't know exactly how it went down, we can extrapolate from other murders to recreate a possible timeline. See, Rodney Alcala, going as John Berger, was known during his time in New York City as a guy who approached women on the street and offered to photograph them, sometimes then and there, and sometimes at a second, more private location.
Never go to a second location.
We talk about privilege a lot in this country, and rightfully so.
Talking
in many
about tall
ways.
Privilege. That's what this is about.
Handsome privilege. Because if any of us go up, take a picture of you. No, but the fact that he...
I take a picture for you for my scrapbook.
$5, $5.
Give him $5. Give him $5 or I'll make him take a picture of you.
$5. It's a good picture.
Yeah.
But the fact... Yes,
yeah. It's a good picture.
The fact he looked like someone who could take a picture of you and make... The fact that was like a plausible thing for someone to be like, yeah, sure. You seem like the kind of guy I would like to have a picture taken from. It's very unique.
That's how it is.
Yes.
That's how it is. Handsome guys are not to be trusted.
Yeah. And most likely, this is how Alcala approached TWA flight attendant Cornelia Criley. And this is all based on the massive amount of photos of women that were in just this situation that were later found in Alcala's storage locker in Seattle.
That's what points us again towards he's done this many, 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 many times.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So after Rodney disarmed Cornelia and made her feel comfortable, he probably offered to take more photos in a private location. And in this case, that location was Cornelia's apartment.
Hmm.
And then from there, he went on to fund and start American Apparel.
Coming in hot
deep
today.
Cut. Hot take,
deep
hot
cut. Boy, that's that is a deep cut.
Yeah,
deep
it really cut. Is. Brought back bush hair.
Yeah.
Remember that?
Yeah, yes, indeed.
Oh, yeah.
Well, probably thinking him charming and maybe good looking, like a lot of women did when they met Rodney, she invited him up to her apartment. And we know that she invited him because there was no sign of forced entry. And Rodney, as far as we know, never coerced potential victims with the threat of violence. Once there, Rodney most likely did take some pictures of her. But eventually, Cornelia began to either slowly or quickly realize that she'd made a mistake inviting this stranger into her home. When Cornelia's body was found days later, her face had been severely beaten. Deep bite marks were found on her breast. She'd been sexually molested. A stocking was tied around her neck, and her bra had been stuffed in her mouth.
Jesus.
By the time the garment was removed from her mouth by investigators, rigor mortis had set in, which fixed her mouth in a permanent, terrified howl. And since no one had seen Cornelia with Rodney, and since forensics were comparatively primitive in 1972, cops never even came close to the man who was bopping around New York under the name of John Berger.
Jesus.
And as a result, Alcala wasn't linked to the crime until 2011.
Wow.
When DNA from saliva samples taken from the bite marks put Rodney in the room.
A lot of his crimes are going to be, we'll even talk about this at the end of the next episode when we do the second episode, is that there are databases of the pictures that he put out, much like they did with Samuel Little, because again, they're still piecing together how many people he might have murdered.
Mm.
Now, detectives in Los Angeles had not forgotten the attempted murder of Tali Shapiro, and they'd spent 3 years trying to track down Rodney Alcala. Finally, they convinced the FBI to add their suspect to the top 10 most wanted list.
Wow.
Luckily for the cops, two girls attending the summer camp where Rodney was celebrating his third year saw the wanted poster in a post office and immediately recognized the man they knew as Mr. Berger as fugitive child rapist and attempted murderer Rodney Alcala.
They're like the first ever true crime fans in the wild, like the first web sleuths, because it was apparently the two girls went and they were like, let's go. They wanted to scare each other with the top 10 wanted list. So they're just like, let's go look at the papers and see all the criminals. Let's go look. Oh, my God. Red wine. Oh, my God. It's amazing. And they go in there and be like, I'm going to love carbs and murderers. And then they looked at these fucking all of the lists and they're like, that's Mr. Burgers.
Dude, that is like such, that is, if it wasn't so disgusting, it's kind of the beginning of the new Goonies or a Steven Spielberg film. Like, it's so, that.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, as a kid, don't you always think, because of Goosebumps R.L. Stein, you always think your teacher is a zombie or something. But then you find out.
If they're a child rapist? That was a rough
Goosebumps.
I mean,
that's where you get your friends together.
This is a summer camp version of The Burbs.
Yeah.
Sure.
But very real.
Yeah, yeah. But The Burbs was lighter
there
almost.
There was some levity to it. There was some levity. Yeah. I like that Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks wasn't in this.
Well, these girls called the cops, and within a short period of time, Alcala was arrested, and his fingerprints were matched to the crime scene in his apartment back in Los Angeles. But when it came time for the trial, Tali Shapiro's family, somewhat understandably, refused to return to Los Angeles to testify.
This is one of those constant things that pop up with kids that are the victims of these types of crimes because the
parents were like, they didn't want her to relive her trauma.
There has to be another way.
Well, that's the thing. I guess the prosecutor here just couldn't fucking be bothered because they went for the sure thing and arranged a piddling plea deal. And this sounds like extraordinarily lazy prosecuting because fucking remember, Officer Camacho saw Alcala in the apartment just before he discovered the crime scene. And that's not even to mention the fact that it was Rodney Alcala's apartment.
Sir, Mr. Alcala. Alcala, whatever it is, sir.
Alcala!
Sure. You've been sentenced to 15 years of reality television.
No! Yes. No! Yes! Oh, God, they're looking at my social media.
And also, Donald, you know, the guy that called the cops in the first place, could identify Rodney Alcala. He saw him take this little girl into an apartment.
Oh, God. But where was he? Did they not call him?
Lazy fucking prosecuting, man.
Oh yeah, this is what I'm telling you.
I feel like this is one of those that you do prosecute.
It's hard because it's not hard. This is a total fuck up.
Okay.
Yeah, this is an extremely large fuck up. Alcala was allowed to dodge the attempted murder charge and instead pled guilty to child molestation, which garnered an indeterminate sentence of 1 to 10 years. Now, what... indeterminate meant was that the parole board, who had no real understanding of the full scope of the crime, they could declare the criminal rehabilitated and set him loose whenever they fucking felt like it. And while this might work just fine for, say, you know, a kid who makes a mistake, it was a fucking terrible idea for someone like Rodney Alcala.
And was there no registry at this point for sexual predators? Were they just gone?
It's weird. We talk about it all the time. Natalie and I talk about it all the time about how back in the day, it was just like child molesting was like not that big of a crime for some reason. There was like, they didn't really look at it as very seriously. I think because there was a prevailing
I'm just
idea
Catholic.
That kids basically, I mean, seriously.
It's like the Cuomo defense. I'm just Italian.
I'm Italian. Look how long my lap is. You mean to tell me I'm not supposed to fill this with kids?
Oh my God.
But like, it is strange where you wonder, like, because they just didn't take the crime very seriously. I wonder if it has the idea that it has to do with the idea that kids, they feel like they won't remember shit or that they're less than people because they're not an adult yet. They can't go to war yet and die for the country.
Maybe. But I think it was also with a lot of people, like, child molestation used to be a lot more prevalent than it is now. A lot of people seriously did say, like, I was molested and look at me. I'm fine.
And don't forget, truly, shame.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
It was the same thing with people who were raped. The victimhood that comes after the victimhood, they just keep it under the rug. That's probably why Tally's parents didn't go.
Oh, yeah, because you keep bringing it up because she said
it's a family shame. It's an embarrassment. It was totally ass backwards.
She specifically said they acted like it didn't happen. She got home and then they acted like it didn't happen and then they just tried to move forward.
Yeah, sure. That's probably not going to help you move forward. I got to deal with it.
By August of 1974, just a little over 2 years past sentencing, a prison psychiatrist declared that Rodney Alcala was, quote, considerably improved.
Yeah, but, it started with him raping and almost murdering a girl, so considerably improved still is not really good.
Listen, I haven't bought candy in a year.
Yeah?
And you know what candy does.
I know.
Which is considerably improved from the days when you used to order Chinese food and they'd send you 4 sets of utensils.
And see? Now I'm down to 3. It's like it's still not good, you see.
Do you think they assume the 4th member of the family just died of diabetes?
No, I think that they assume that it's just one person that are trying to be nice.
From your grave.
Well, after the prison psychiatrist said he was considerably improved, Rodney Alcala was released and required to register as a sex offender in Monterey Park, California, where he moved back in with his mother. And that's what I mean by, you know, earlier when you asked, like, you know, is he just trying to hide the crime? No, he went to prison as a child molester for 2 years. Within months of his release, Rodney, not surprisingly, tried killing again in much the same way he tried to kill Tali Shapiro. This time, Rodney was cruising Huntington Beach in a station wagon when he spotted a 13-year-old girl waiting for her school bus. Again, Alcala asked her if she wanted to see a pretty picture. And again, the girl, known only as Julie, she climbed into the car under the promise that Rodney would just be giving her a ride to school.
This is where today's generation, maybe they are more safe. They'd be like, no, I don't want to see a fucking picture.
I see pictures all fucking day.
I see pictures all fucking day.
But this time, Rodney went by the name of John Roald. Or maybe it's Roald. It's either
Roald.
Way, it's a
it's
fucking
like Roald Dahl.
Ah.
Mm, classic.
And when he drove past Julie's school without slowing down, she started yelling and tried jumping out of the moving vehicle. Rodney, in response, grabbed her and held her until they reached a secluded location near some cliffs off the Pacific Coast Highway. After stopping, he forced her to walk with him until they reached a private location, and there he made her smoke a joint before embarking on the beginnings of a rape and possible murder. Thankfully, though, before things got deadly or even violent, an angel of a park ranger showed up investigating the weed smell.
Oh, man, technically, I would be mad about this if he didn't stop a fucking rape and murder. You know what I mean? Get down, he's just smoking weed in the park. Where else is he supposed to smoke weed?
I am just a park ranger bear. And, oh, I smell marijuana.
Oh, my God.
My God, there's something far worse going on.
It's a fucking bear with a hat on.
I'm sorry. You're going to have to let that young girl go. Give me that joint.
Rodney tried lying by saying...
It's her weed.
Yeah, right.
You see, he was saying they were just taking a break from a hike.
Yeah, I always smoke a joint with a 12-year-old in the park.
I mean,
but Julie yelled that she'd been forced there and wanted to go home. Not knowing what to do, the ranger just arrested both of them because of the weed.
Wait a second, we just got fucking handcuffs? What does he do for arrested moose? What does a park ranger have handcuffs for?
Well,
for people I've smoking
got
weed.
Handcuffs for
but
smoking.
You're a bear. You should be able to just frighten people by your presence alone.
No, I've got a series of handcuffs. I'll put the big handcuffs on the big man, and I'll put the little handcuffs on the girl.
I just feel like they're made out of wood.
Well, Julie was let go immediately. But after doing a background check, it was found that Alcala was out on parole for child molestation.
Okay, time to put him back in the clink.
Charged with sale of marijuana and kidnapping. And he was sent back to prison.
Probably for the marijuana charge, mostly.
Honestly.
Yeah, actually, it probably was. He was out within a couple years. Declared reformed.
He's reformed again.
Again, yeah, again.
Wow,
even though,
you're right.
Even though he kidnapped a young girl 3 months after being let out of prison. No, this time. But this time, though.
Your Honor, I'm going to say, number one, honestly, you're right. Number two, I will never smoke weed again.
That is not the problem.
You're right. Weed for me is over.
Wow. Totally reformed.
Now, to give you an idea just how charming Rodney Alcala could be, he convinced his parole officer to give him permission to roam the country freely, despite the fact that Rodney had tried killing one little girl and had kidnapped another months after being released.
Listen, I talked to Rodney. He's got it out of his system. All right? He's done with it.
Oh, my God.
Listen to me. Listen, you know for a fact. Look at me. You look at me. If you could see a little fuel gauge on me that had child molesting juice in it, you'd see it's that empty.
It's that empty. Great. Why don't you roam free?
Once the okay was given, Alcala went to San Francisco, where he met Pamela Lamson at Fisherman's Wharf. All we know is that they left together and Pamela's mutilated body was found on a Marin County hiking trail soon after.
Oh, my God.
After that murder, Rodney left California with the blessing of his parole officer and returned to New York City in July of 1977, just a month before David Berkowitz was arrested for the Son of Sam murders. Son of Sam's in full swing right now.
Wow.
On July 13th, the day of the historic 1977 blackout, Alcala approached a socialite named Ellen Hoover, who just happened to be the goddaughter of Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr. This woman was fucking connected.
Wow.
Ooh. Well, from what friends later said, Ellen Hoover found this photographer going by the name of John Berger again to be charming and flirty. And after he pressured her into a lunch date, she accepted. Ellen Hoover disappeared completely on the day of the date, and no one would know what happened to her for almost a year. Now, the only reason why we know that this is one of Rodney's was because Ellen had the name John Berger written in her appointment book on the day she disappeared. Interestingly, though, it was thought at the time that Ellen might have been another Son of Sam victim because she had long, dark hair, and they still didn't really know anything about the actual killer himself.
No.
But while the NYPD had the serial killer part right, the investigation wouldn't zero in on Alcala for a very long time.
Mm.
Damn.
But even while the cops tried to track down the mysterious Mr. Burger, Alcala had already left New York City to escape the heat of a high-profile victim, and he was on his way back across the country to Los Angeles when he claimed another victim.
Oh yeah, God. You get out of my town, okay, yes. Giggle? You Giggle. Don't even come back here. All right, yeah, you go back to Los Angeles with your short shorts. This is New York City, baby, and it's not a... Oh, it's a, fun, a single change in season, and I can barely move.
Yes, the truth.
The allergies that are going through my body right now, yeah. It's like, oh, it's like Stalingrad or something.
That's a very suffering. Appropriate thing to say, yeah. They could have just caught Berkowitz by laying a bunch of hamburgers out and directing them towards the police precinct and be like,
oh, so innocent hamburgers. Oh, yeah, look at you. Oh, it's a treasure for me. Oh, they say one man's burgers is another man's burgers.
Okay.
Oh, I've been called by the police. Oh. I can able strike.
Oh, man, we got another one.
28-year-old Christine Thornton was 6 months pregnant and had just left her boyfriend when she crossed Rodney's path in Wyoming. A picture of Christine looking happy and comfortable was found in Rodney's storage locker years later, and Rodney most likely killed her moments after the picture was taken.
It's also interesting that his storage locker was in Seattle, which is the other serial killer capital of the world. I actually just saw this. I didn't know that actually more serial killers came out of Seattle than any other city in the 1970s.
Wow. Yep.
From Thornton's dead body, he took earrings. Earrings would become Rodney's favorite trophy to take from victims. And when that fucking storage locker was discovered after his arrest, investigators found a bag containing a disturbing number of them.
Wow.
Once back in Los Angeles, though, Rodney walked into the offices of the Los Angeles Times and brazenly applied for a typesetter position under his real name, which by this time was attached to two serious crimes against children.
Yeah, exactly what we're looking for. We've been looking for a pedophile all week.
LA Times.
But despite having been on the top 10 most wanted list, and despite his conviction for child molestation, and despite his parole violations for making a little girl smoke weed after he kidnapped her, and despite being registered as a sex offender, Rodney got the job.
I'm starting to think these journalists don't do a lot of research.
You know, man, when it comes
or at
down
least the
to
hiring
it,
practices are pretty. The hiring practices of the Los Angeles said no background checks.
HR is more militant than the U.S. military. The fact he got through HR.
This is back before HR. I don't know what you'd call this, but also when it comes down to it, taking a picture is hard, guys. And finding somebody, it's so hard. And it's so hard to find somebody that could take a picture where everybody stays in a picture.
It wasn't 1760 where you got one shot at it.
I don't know.
Well, he wasn't hired as a photographer. He was hired as a typesetter. I mean, he was a little bit gruntier.
Yeah, that's where he put the
staff photographer.
If you're going to put him somewhere, that's where he put him. The janitors, you know what I mean? That's where you put him.
Well, I think they like to pepper him through a little bit in the executive branch, a little bit through the...
While Alcala was known around the office mostly as a charming, hardworking individual who casually shared stories about running into famous people in Greenwich Village, and he was able to do so in a way that made him appear cool instead of desperate.
Ooh.
Very good at name dropping.
Yeah, so this one time I was taking a piss in a bush, and you wouldn't believe it. I was pissing on a very fancy shoe. Wouldn't you believe it was the incredible Richard Burton?
Wow,
from
Richard.
Yes, Richard Burton was there, and I was peeing on him, and he couldn't have been more gracious.
Well, what another great story from the weird guy in the basement.
But there was another side to Rodney Alcala at the Los Angeles Times. This wasn't even something that was going on outside of work. This was in the office. This behavior was written off insanely as, oh, he's just an avant-garde person. Rodney would show off his portfolio of photographs to coworkers, and that portfolio was full of pictures of naked little girls.
Again, just imagine he looked like Milton from Office Space. And he is reported immediately.
See my collection of my frozen angels.
I can't believe it. So everyone was just looking at these pictures like, that's a very artistic picture of pedophilia there. Whoa. Thank you, Rodney.
This is fun.
Well, I mean, it's a thing. Rodney Alcala was a good photographer. If you look at his pictures,
yeah, but
there's
it matters
talent.
What you're taking pictures of, doesn't it?
This is an incredible picture of this naked girl's body.
Well, that's first of all. Second of all, he's telling his coworkers, I took these pictures at the request of the kid's parents. And for some reason, everybody's just too worried about looking unhip to say, dude, this is fucked up.
So we were going to do our family portrait at JCPenney's, but I really wanted to see Wendy naked, right? That's my 9-year-old daughter. And I was like, why can't I find the right... And I told them at JCPenney. I told them at JCPenney, we're trying to do something new here. They wouldn't do it, so we had to go to Ocala Photography.
I thought this was JCPenney, and we were going to do it nice.
Oh, my God.
I got my balls out. No dick.
No dick.
Why is this such a fucking problem?
You're going to want to go to Sears for that.
Well, he did it in such a way where it, like, looks arty. Like, they're not, like, dark fucking... They're not dark Polaroids, like, in a room with a single light bulb hanging above it.
You give them, like, a beach ball, and then you just, like, honestly, you give them, like, you put, ha, I don't even know what you do.
You can put fucking hat on a piece of shit, and you'd be like, look at this very nice picture of a cowboy, and be like, no, that's still a piece of shit. And then these kids, that's obviously pedophilia.
Do you remember the difference between Red Shoe Diaries and Hot Springs Hotel? It's that. It's one diaphanous red sheet.
Well, Red Shoe had a mystery attached to it there.
Yeah, there was more plot.
Yeah, of course. And Shannon tweet. Thank you, Shannon.
Well, upon further reflection, those same people who just awkwardly smiled and nodded at these pictures, they later acknowledged that they were looking at homemade child pornography, not only in full public view, but in the workplace.
Another victim of cancel culture. Cannot believe it. Where we're at in this call. This culture has gotten away from us, man.
Being cool doesn't really matter, just so everybody knows out there.
Yeah,
so
don't
if you see
cool.
child abuse happening, trust me, it ages poorly, no matter what the social situation might be now.
Yeah. Well, it's around this time, though, that Rodney Alcala escalated from simple murder to fully posing the bodies of the victims he'd killed. But unlike Danny Rowling, who posed as victims in their own homes to shock the cops when they discovered the bodies, Rodney posed the victims in public to shock and traumatize anyone who happened upon the gruesome scenes.
Like the Times Square? Like in the middle of a town center?
No, mostly hiking trails.
Another reason not to hike. Thank you. This show has really helped me not exercise.
It really is.
Yeah, that's not the only place. There are, like, we'll get to another one later. But yeah, I mean, places where it's going to be found and where it's going to be found soon. In early November 1977, Alcala lured and killed 17-year-old Jill Barkham, who just moved to Los Angeles from Oneida, New York, to follow her dreams like so many others who met a gruesome end in the City of Angels.
Damn.
Yeah, man. Headshots, man.
It's just so sad.
Again, all we have is how the body was found and what the coroner's report said. But from those sources, we know that Jill Barkham went through a terrible torture before she was posed near a service road off Mulholland Drive. And this, by the way, this is definite gold star.
I'm thinking they should just rename Mulholland Drive. It seems like the term is cursed.
That's what's fun about it, though.
Oh, God.
Rigor mortis had set in by the time Jill Barkham was found on all fours, with her knees bent and pointing outward. The top of her head was touching the ground to balance the body in its ghastly position, and her face was tucked so tightly against her chest that it appeared as if her neck was broken. She was naked from the waist down, and blood had pooled in the dirt below the body from the massive anal wounds suffered when Rodney raped her. Her face had been beaten, a ligature had been used to strangle her, a bite had nearly severed the nipple from her right breast, and her pubic hair was singed. But despite the elaborate nature of the torture, Rodney Alcala had killed Jill Barkham by caving in her skull with a rock.
Oh my God.
She had been alive for every bit of the torture leading up to that. And since there were no barefoot prints in the dirt, cops knew that the murder had taken place elsewhere. As far as leads went, there was plenty of DNA evidence, but again, this was 1977. Cops interviewed surrounding neighbors, including Marlon Brando, of all people.
Oh, yeah, because he happened like right next to his house.
Yeah.
Jesus, criminy.
But for the most part...
Could have possibly been there. I would never kill a woman just away. Honestly, if I was going to kill a woman, I'd probably, to be honest, if I was going to do it, I'd drown in my pool.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, only just because that's why I got the pool. I mean, I'm not going to say I'm going to say that out loud. It's not why I got the pool. Wink, okay? Wink, okay? I'm an actor. All right, I say fun things.
Yeah, I'm happy you took this opportunity to do your Marlon Brando impression. This is the time. It's really good.
It's a good one. It's a good one. As far as Marlon Brando impression, it's solid.
Well, yeah. I love milk.
I know you do, Marlon. I know you do.
For the most part, the cops were fucking stumped. Now, this time, Rodney Alcala had dropped a body right into the middle of the Hillside Strangler investigation.
Oh, my yes. God.
And in an amazing coincidence, Jill Barkham actually knew Judith Miller, who had been killed by Angelo Buono and Jennifer Bianchi less than 2 weeks earlier.
I actually don't think...
Is anybody safe?
No.
Not 1977, man.
No. Not this year. But I do believe in my own mind, if what we know about serial killers holds to be true about other serial killers, he knew about the Hillside Strangler crimes, yeah, and it was following them. Like, he was probably following the Son of Sam crimes when he went to New York, and he positioned the body specifically so that it could possibly get lumped in with the Hillside Stranglers. We now know that he has his own MO, but I do believe that, like, he was playing a bunch of different angles at
right.
once.
So he's a copycat killer, but not in a traditional sense.
Somewhat. I don't think he went. I don't think he really thought about Son of Sam. I think he enjoyed going to a city where fear was ruling. I don't think he had. I think that would just happen to be like, I'll go to New York. I know I can kill people there. With the Hillside Stranglers, though, I think he was trying to top them. I think what he did. And the way he left bodies and posed them, far worse than anything. The Hillside Stranglers just fucking dumped the bodies.
Yeah.
And he's trying to take things to the next level. He's trying to top them because he's playing a game the whole time.
It's all of the posing. It's the same thing with Danny Rawling. It's this about of leaving a message after the fact so other people are traumatized.
And just hear the song, anything you can do, I can do better. And it's like, okay, well, that's not what this song's about.
It's scary. It's going to be slowed down for a trailer soon, so don't say that.
Oh, yeah. That's a good point.
Now, by this point, the walls were starting to close in a little on Rodney Alcala, but he still managed to talk his way out of it. NYPD investigators had finally discovered that John Berger, whose name had been in Ellen Hover's diary on the day of her disappearance, was the alias of Rodney Alcala, convicted child rapist.
Gotcha.
And it didn't take him, I mean, not that long, especially considered how, like, the NYPD had just wrapped up the Son of Sam murders. They're still dealing with thousands of murders every year in New York City. So they're getting around to it.
Yeah, because actually when the Son of Sam murders are finally wrapped up, they're like, there we go. That's six of them handled. Oh, fuck.
Oh, shoot. Gosh, darn it.
So they asked the LAPD to bring in Rodney Alcala for questioning and a lie detector test. But since Rodney refused the test, as was his right, and since cops had nothing linking him to Ellen Hover besides a name and a diary, they were forced to let him go. They had nothing. And
I guess it's a lot, though. He was the last person to see her fucking alive.
Yeah.
Maybe a few questions could have helped there.
I don't know. But I get also, lie detector tests also do nothing.
No, they don't do anything.
They do nothing. But that's the thing. They can only hold him for, what, 48 hours?
I was speaking with Dr. Don Castaldi for a Patreon episode, and he said, you know when a psychopath is lying on a lie detector test because you'll see it afterwards. So there'll be a spike after all the questions, and they'll be like, how'd I do? Because they're so excited to like trick the lie detector test. So it's actually they detect when someone's a psychopath afterwards based on how excited they are by the results.
Whoa.
So that's a little bit interesting.
That's interesting. That's how you game it then, I guess.
That's how you game it. But
that's a hot tip for you, the listener.
So disconnect before you show how thrilled you are for passing because you're a psychopath.
Well, because nothing came of the polygraph test, Rodney Alcala continued killing. About a month after the murder of Jill Barkham, Rodney escalated again. Instead of luring a victim into a trap, it appears as if Rodney broke into someone's apartment for his next murder, a la Richard Ramirez. See, when the cops were called about a welfare check for a girl named Georgia Wixted, who hadn't shown up for work or responded to phone calls, they noticed that the screen was missing from one of her windows and was propped up against a wall nearby. That doesn't definitively say that he broke into her apartment, but it's definitely a possibility.
Mm-hmm. Or it's how he got out.
Yeah. When they searched the apartment, they found the body of Georgia Wixted, posed just as gruesomely as Jill Barkham and killed just as brutally, this time in her own bed. Blood was everywhere, soaked into the mattress, splattered on the walls, and smeared on the toilet by the perpetrator while he was in the process of cleaning himself.
Oh my God. It reminds me a little bit, and what do you guys think, like Killdozer, fantastic documentary. The guy who created the machine was like, they haven't stopped me. If they really wanted to stop me, they'd see what I was doing and they'd stop me. Do you think at some point he's getting away with all of this shit where he's like, I guess this is allowed?
I do believe that there is a sense of invincibility that you get when you've been picked up by the cops several times
and they just
released.
Don't stop him.
I mean, I think it's more that they think it's, instead of like, this is allowed, it's more, this is nature. They see themselves as tigers or bears or something like that, and everyone
the
else
red dragon
is,
thing
yeah the red dragon thing, they see everyone else as lowly sheep. So to him, this is like, oh, this is the natural order of things. Well, somewhere between 2:15 a.m. and sunrise, Rodney had broken in, subdued Georgia Wixted, and strangled her with a knotted pair of pantyhose before ripping her flesh with one side of a claw hammer, then beating her to death with the other. Rodney left behind more DNA and a palm print, but again, these clues were useless without the technology to match the former and an identifying print to link the latter.
But I don't even understand how he should have had the identifying print. He's been arrested three times.
Don't they have the fingerprints?
They don't have any database to check it against. And like, if you just have a bunch of fucking cards, like, you know, yeah. And he probably didn't have a palm print. He just had probably just had his fingerprints.
We need to split the difference between hellacious sci-fi Tom Cruise films and this.
Oh yeah,
isn't that sweet spot? I think that's called 1999.
Yeah, we're close. We are like technically we're closer than ever, which is what Marcus and I talked about. It probably really does lead to the reason why there's less serial killers going on and more mass shooters. But you know, it is rough.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, but you know, don't worry. Apple's going to fix everything. They're going to check our phones. Mm-hmm. Don't worry. They're going to look into all our pictures and make sure that we don't have a single bit of thought crime going on in there. Don't worry about it.
Now, Rodney was questioned by police a few months after this murder, but not in connection to any of the murders he committed. Instead, Rodney received a visit from the Hillside Stranglers Task Force.
Oh, it's a lot of cops going on at once.
Yeah. They took him off the suspects list after the interview because he had an alibi for every single night of every single Hillside Strangler murder, but they did arrest him for pot possession.
Oh my God. All right. And how long did he got? And that's where he got 30 years, and that's the end of our episode. And thank God for the war on drugs.
Although very quickly released on parole. Very quickly released, which is insane considering how many people are still in fucking prison for pot possession.
And
which
again, this guy is just
like
fucking...
It's like hypocritical. It seems to be like they use it for other means. It seems like they use it to get other agendas across. I don't know. Maybe
if
I'm crazy.
If he looked different, he would have been arrested a long time ago.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. 3 months later, Rodney killed a woman named Zafar Shah, then grotesquely posed her naked, bloodied body in the laundry room of an apartment complex El Segundo.
Jesus.
I'd be so pissed, man, because sometimes, especially back in the day when I had to go to the laundry room that was in the
building.
It's
a scary spot to begin with.
By the time I'm there, I've already got, like, I got no clothes left.
No.
Yeah. You know what I mean? Now it's a crime scene?
Oh, my God.
I'll never get to work again.
Yeah, you'll never do laundry again, and that's the least of our worries here.
He'd posed her on her back with her legs spread open towards the door, so the lewd display would be the first thing seen upon walking into the room. Her arms were bent back. Blood was splattered on a piece of wood nearby, and Rodney had bizarrely tied a sandal to a shoelace and strung it around the victim's neck.
It's like childlike playing.
Yeah. Now, at about the same time that Zafar Shah's body was discovered by some unlucky tenant, Ellen Hover's bones were found in a shallow grave just north of New York City near Tarrytown on the Rockefeller Estate, which is now a park where I walk my dog with my wife.
Isn't that amazing? Things do get better.
I had a great time in Tarrytown. Brooke and I, we saw Roger McGuinn.
Yeah, that's nice. Also, me and Ragnar and Holden once did mushrooms in that park. We had a great time.
Oldest cemetery, you're one of the oldest ones in America. That's where the Rockefellers are buried.
It's all about making new memories.
Isn't that nice? Anyway.
Well, once the discovery of the body was made public, a young woman came forward and said that she'd had an extensive photography session with a guy named Rodney Alcala near the exact location where Hover's remains were found. And despite all this, despite the fact that he'd now killed over half a dozen women, and had tried killing a little girl, and was now coming close to being a suspect in a murder in New York City, less than 2 months after killing Zafar Shah, Rodney Alcala, appeared as a contestant on a nationally televised game show called The Dating Game.
Ba-na-na,
ba-na-na. Oh my God.
And that's where we'll pick back up for the conclusion to our series on Rodney Alcala.
Yeah, dog, we got some stuff on fucking The Dating Game next week. I'm excited to delve a little bit into the complicated world of Chuck Barris and what his insanity.
That's a whole side quest on this thing.
It is, yeah. And then we will get into how Rodney Alcala is finally stopped for his crimes, but he's going to do a lot more before he gets there.
And how we took a sociopathy into the courtroom when he defended himself.
Oh, yes. Right. Very
Bundy-esque. And the man who defends himself in court, he has a fool for a client.
Indeed he does. And a dumb shit lawyer as well, which is he. All right. Wow. I had no idea how frickin' we've heard the story. And I'm like, oh, he's a killer. But holy shit, that man is fucking disgusting.
Yeah, yeah, oh yeah. It is interesting to see the ones that are quote-unquote not heavy hitters, like not the classic, quote-unquote classic. You know, serial killer classic, if you're going to use that in the Coca-Cola font.
Sure.
Like that type of shit. It's because a lot of times the reason why they aren't the quote-unquote heavy hitters that we talk about all the time is because they were weirdly more successful at being a murderer. And they went for longer periods of time of not getting caught. And quite a bit of the time, they were not searching for attention. They were just trying to cause as much much violence and mayhem as they could.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely. And I think there's also with what kind of killers are covered, there's kind of a sweet spot when it comes to how brutal the murders are. Like, yeah. I think the reason why Ted Bundy is so, you know, it's so hugely covered because, you know, Ted Bundy is a good looking guy. Rodney Alcala is a good looking guy. It's not just the good looking part.
No.
I think it's also that he had really, like, Ted Bundy's crimes can kind of just be papered over. And there's that one, like, gross detail. Like, he went back and had sex with the dead bodies and put makeup on the faces and did their hair.
Yeah, yeah.
That's, like, there's the one detail. But it's Rodney Alcala.
Gross. That's what I always say. It's like super gross.
Yeah.
Yuck.
Yeah.
Gross Ted.
Or there's got to be like a hook with Richard Ramirez. His, you know, his crimes are really fucking brutal, but it's Satanism. There's that hook to it. And people like Rodney Alcala, it's just, and you know, Danny Rowling for that matter. Like, it's just, it's so brutal and so beyond the pale that it's impossible to talk about.
And we talk about the mic. We talk about the micro of, you know, being shamed as a sexual assault survivor, and I suppose the macro in this case too. Everyone's just so embarrassed. Perhaps law enforcement fucked up as a country. Do we want to live in a world where you can have someone like that even live?
I mean,
maybe no one wants to talk about the fact it's children that are being raped and murdered. Anyway, all right. Well, we will get to part two of this. Holy hell! Holy hell! I'm starting to think this guy should not have won that fucking dating game.
We'll get to it.
All right.
We'll get to it. Well, he is a banana.
Yeah.
So
thank
we'll
you. Thank you all so much for listening. Bye. Are we? Do we have
by
anything?
By the way, Last Prisoner Project.
Yes.
Take a look at them. Pre-order our comic book October 5th at your local comic book store, Soul Plumber. It is on DC. Check it out.
And be sure to order that. Be sure to put it on your pull list either this week or next week. You got to put it on now to make sure that your copy gets ordered. So, and make sure, go to your local comic book store. You got to go this week or next week if you want to be guaranteed a copy.
Guaranteed.
This shit's going to sell out. So make sure that you reserve your copy with your local comic book store.
Yes.
And spend some more money while you're there.
Yeah, come
Read
on, man. Give
man.
It. There's more horrible ways to spend your money than at a comic book store. You can buy a bunch of bullets and distribute them at a school. So go and get comic books. And also,
read Ice Cream Man. Read Department of Truth. Have a fucking great time.
It's fucking sweet. This Sunday, we have our mugshot roast. It is on twitch.tv/lastpodcastnetwork.
Yeah.
It is hosted by the glorious ham boy, Ed Larson. Kissel couldn't find his mugshot.
I got two mugshots, one with the DUI when I was 19, one when I was detained in the tombs, but they weren't felonies. So there's no mugshot, and I'm actually a little bit sad about that.
Commit bigger crimes, Kissel. And it is this Sunday, the September 12th. The National Hangover Day, I think we should start calling it. And you go, it's starting 5 p.m. Pacific, and it's on our Twitch channel. And join us. We're doing it all for charity. We're raising money for Last Prisoner Project. And it is going to be a really good time. And we're going to see a lot of really horrible mugshots.
Absolutely. And if you want a great insight into prison and why we need prison reform, I did an interview with Larry Lawton. And it was just fantastic in the amount of abuses that individuals suffer at the hands of our monetized prison system. Is not right and un-American.
It is.
All right, everyone. Thanks so much for listening. Hail yourself.
Hail Satan.
Hail Gein.
My congratulations.
Hail me.
Yes, indeed.
Let the girl go.
Always. And don't go to JCPenney's if you want to have a nude family photo.
If you want to have a nude family, yeah, go to Sears.
Gotta go to Sears.
And shoot for private. Get that photographer, because, you know, a lot of these photographers, they're sick of doing weddings.
Sure.
This show is made possible by listeners like you. Thanks to our ad sponsors. You can support our shows by supporting them. For more shows like the one you just listened to, go to lastpodcastnetwork.com.